Did you know that the dog days of summer is a term invented by the Romans? The dog days begin at the end of July when the dog star, or Sirius, begins to rise in the morning just before the sun. With its summertime appearance, the Romans believed that Sirius added more heat to our solar system's sun. The dog star gives us these dog days of summer.
Welcome to the Lore of the South. Lore of the South.
Follow the show on social media to keep up with what's going on and to see pics that go along with each episode. Search for Lore of the South on TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook.
Welcome back to Lore of the South with me, Kelly Cruz. How the heck are y'all doing? We're going to be doing this episode a little bit different today. Producer Mike will be joining me shortly to talk about the Wrath of Idalia. And that's how we're going to say it, because it's like Vidalia without the V. So we say Idalia. I don't care how the weathermen say it. But y'all, it has left a path of destruction again across rural North Florida that is unlike anything we've seen around here in quite some time. And it is getting little to no coverage. And these folks need help. It has hit some of the most rural and poorest areas in Florida. The news people were so happy when it didn't hit Tampa or highly populated areas or whatever. But here's the difference. Those areas have the infrastructure to take care of these sorts of disasters. We do not up here. They're pretty much relying on themselves and local churches. And I believe FEMA is here now, but all they do is make lists and send you a check. They're not out there putting your roof back on your house for you or making sure that you have food to eat. They're handing out, you know, vouchers, that sort of thing. So, producer Mike, who travels all over North Florida, is going to be joining us to talk about what he has seen while making his deliveries. We'll post a few links in the show notes if anybody has anything that they can contribute to the relief effort here. I'm also going to post links to a couple of YouTubers that I follow, Paleo Chris and Wild Kyle. They're both rock hounds, and they go all over our little creeks and our rivers and stuff. If you're into fossil hunting, follow them. Again, it's Paleo Chris is one channel and Wild Kyle is the other. Super entertaining and knowledgeable guys. I have learned so much about like the local fossils from this area. Like, I had no idea there were like mastodons and camels and things like that in North Florida until watching these two. What else? So I guess I'm gonna break here and let producer Mike work his magic for our little sit down interview about what he's seen in the local areas. Hey y'all, producer Mike's here with me. Say hey, producer Mike.
Hey.
And like I said before, I brought him in to talk about some of the damage and destruction he has seen while driving around North Florida delivering the Pepperidge Farm goodies.
Yeah. It was definitely an eye-opening experience, especially for somebody who's lived in Florida my whole life. And we've seen a number of these hurricanes come through in my lifetime. Now, we've seen pictures, and we've all seen, like, video from the Weather Channel of destruction and this and that. And it's all very impactful until you go out and you see it for the first time yourself. And these places that you've been, like, I've been running the same route for over 15 years and driving around in some of these places that you've driven past 2-3 times a week for 15 years are just
obliterated.
Yeah.
One of his stops is a retirement community. It's called Advent Christian Village. It's in a very rural area of Suwanee County called Dowling Park. It's like on the border of Lafayette, which everybody else in the country probably says Lafayette, but we say Lafayette here for some reason. But he said that that little retirement village looks like a bomb went off.
Like it looks like a literal war zone. Now, I don't want to put things too much into perspective. I mean, they still have their hospital, which was still active. They still had their little grocery store that was active, you know, and stuff. But it's just the scenery and everything had damage. Everything.
Yeah, and then, a lot of these places, like, that's part of what keeps that little tiny community afloat.
Yeah.
is that retirement village that's out there. Mm-hmm. It's owned by that Advent Church.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a step up facility or step down facility.
Yeah, it all depends on how you would how you view it.
Yeah. So you start off in your little house, and then as you age or, you know, some other ailment takes you know, then you can go to assisted living and then into a nursing care. Home and then they have like a hospice care there for these folks. And they take bus trips into town a couple of times a week, and some of the nicest people you will ever meet in your life. And
to me, what happened in the storm, that was the easternmost edge of what I would call destruction. We had, like, we got hit, but we had a few limbs down, a few trees down, nothing compared to what I saw out there.
Yeah. I mean, like, we had a tree come down before the storm. That's our luck. Not in the storm, mm-hmm. before the storm.
Yeah.
And, I mean, like, in comparison, here, we went one day without power. These people are, like, going on 2 weeks with no electricity.
And there's still no confirmation of how long it's going to be, because the infrastructure out there just isn't.
It isn't.
It's not in place. It's not underground. Like, a lot of cities and more modern places.
More metro
now.
Areas.
Yeah. Everything's, all your utilities are run underground. Well, their power is all ran on power poles and power lines.
Yeah. And what's real wild is, like, and I think they did it all the way out to Suwannee County. We got what they call hurricane poles installed. They're these huge steel and concrete poles that, I mean, like, they tower over the tallest pine
probably
trees.
Probably 4 or 5 stories tall.
They're huge. And even those didn't make it through Idalia. And also, these are some of the poorest communities in our state. North Florida is the most rural and poorest areas in our state. We don't see those tax dollars and the influx of money from tourists. These are farming communities that have been struck.
We are 80% farming community. I mean, now our little town is a little bit of, we pretty much handle traffic coming into Florida. And if this is this nice place to stop, you get something to eat, stay the night, and then head on down to wherever else you're going. But these communities that I'm talking about, I mean, when I talk about the places that I went, if you went 30 more miles to the west, that is where the eye hit.
Right.
And we're talking about kind of in between, if you're looking at a map, it'd be in between Gainesville and Tallahassee. And that there's a strip there that goes next to us that's... It's very rural there. I mean, the place it hit is a fishing camp.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Yeah, I haven't even heard them speak about Suwannee, the mm-hmm. little town that's right on the coast. I think it's north of Cedar Key, I think. We'd have to get out Google Maps. All of those kind of little fishing towns, like, kind of run together to me in my mm-hmm. head. But I think Steinhatchee got it pretty bad, Suwannee, and Cedar Key.
Yeah.
And Cedar Key is probably the most touristy out of those three. But even then, it's like a retirement artist community slash fishing village.
Yeah.
There's a causeway, one causeway in and out of this place.
Mm-hmm.
And if y'all watch those videos that I'm going to link from Wild Kyle and Paleo Chris, they're going to show you that the road was literally, the water came in probably 12 feet high, 8 to 12 feet high in the storm surge, literally picked the road up off of this causeway and just set it down next to where the road used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's insane. And that's the only way in and out of this island is this causeway. And it's gone. Who knows how long it's going to take for the state to come back in there and repair that. I mean, it's passable if you're in a truck.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, you know... And they're having to pull together and fix this stuff themselves. I believe our sheriff's department has even gone to some of the more rural areas to try to help enforce curfews and things like that, just because it's not safe for people still to be outside after dark. And there's not a lot of help. We've got FEMA setting up booths. I believe the Live Oak Walmart, which is also Suwannee County, their Walmart brought in a washing and dryer, like a laundromat truck trailer, mm-hmm. and a portable shower place so that people could bathe and do some laundry.
And if you think about this, this is stuff we've heard like here. I have heard very little from the town of Perry, which I used to deliver to years ago. But like, there's no real news coming out of that place. And that place was devastating.
Yeah.
The whole town only has 7,000 people. I mean, it's not a large population, right. But you know, there's the, we heard but, that one poor. Of the grocery, and one of the grocery stores, we heard the roof got ripped off.
And yeah, and we know the people, some of the people that work there. Yeah.
And, they may not open again. I mean, it's one of those deals where it's like the building and the area got so, it's like, it's not.
It's the value isn't there isn't for, there. I believe it's a Winn-Dixie. So yeah. Southeastern Grocers, which is now owned by Aldi's. But especially Aldi's being the new parent company of Southeastern Grocers, they're going to come in and say, is the value and the income from the store worth us repairing it? Because the little strip mall that this store sits in is abandoned.
Completely empty.
Yeah. Was it the one there or in Madison that half of it burnt down?
I believe that was in Madison. Which also got...
is wrecked.
Yeah.
So we have all these teeny little towns, and they used to be... And let me tell you, they have some beautiful architecture in them. These used to be like big spots, stopping points on for train travel. And some of them were even resort towns at one time. I believe Madison actually had like a car manufacturing plant one time until the railroad stopped going through there.
The interstate actually killed.
Yeah, killed a lot of it. Mm-hmm. So these are areas that need help. I'm going to post a few links. I think it's mostly churches and locals that are doing the bulk of the work. I haven't heard of any like Red Cross people being on the ground.
No.
But usually you have it's that usually stuff that's covered FEMA and churches. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to get some links for y'all. If anybody has a way of donations, and I don't even know if it's so much money. These people need supplies. Mm-hmm. And they need boots on the ground to help them dig out. Mm-hmm. So if y'all know of anything and can help, have anything to spare, you know, check into these resources that I'm going to gather for y'all. It may take me a day or two. I'm just keep checking after this episode's posted, because as I get more information, I'll add to the show notes. Mm-hmm. And also follow our social media, because I'll be posting stuff there. Actually, that may be faster if you check our social media, because sometimes it takes a while for show notes to update. But yeah, we just wanted to try to help get the word out, y'all.
Even with our little platform.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have that many listeners, but if y'all want to see some of the damage for yourselves, y'all look up. I'm going to post links for Paleo, Chris, and Wild Collie, like I said. Also, if you just go search some of the names of these towns on TikTok or on YouTube, they'll show you firsthand what's happening there. And they're just not getting the coverage. The Weather Channel came in, and where'd they go to? They went to two of the biggest cities in Florida, and we're like, oh, well, it's not hitting here. Yay. Well, the little guys got it, y'all, and the little guys need help.
And the only thing that really, I think, kept it from gaining any traction as news is because even when the one hit in the panhandle a couple years ago, like, it hit Category 5, which made it a record for the area and yada, yada,
yada. That was
yada,
Michael, right?
I think so. And this one, even though it might not have been quite as catastrophic as that one was by literally wiping things off the map, it's almost worse because it left pockets of people who need help that they need just enough where you're not really getting help.
Well, too, and I'll leave y'all with this one last thing. A really good friend of mine, and he was just, you know, he's now teaching in Germany, and he's from one of these little communities. It's called Jasper. He was practically, you know, born and raised there up until, you know, adulthood, and he moved on and everything, but he still owns a home there and a rental property. His family's still there, and those places are devastated, and a lot of those people are living in old home family homesteads, meaning that these properties could be 50 to over 100 years old. They are not up to the same kind of regulations.
No, or building codes or any of that stuff.
To what these places are on the coast. And then a lot of poor folks, y'all, if their homes are paid for, or even if they can't afford homeowners insurance.
There's no insurance. Yeah.
I think one of our last insurance companies that covered mobile homes and older properties left the state. And that's happening more and more in Florida. We're losing more and more insurance companies, homeowners insurance companies.
Yeah, but that's a totally different
topic. I mean, like, but that's, I'm just saying that that's, you know, another reason that these places are struggling. I mean, like, they can't even pay to help themselves. Right. They don't have any options. So I'm going to post links and, you know, anything that y'all could do, even if it's, I don't know, send some kind words to some of these people who are helping. We just had a group of missionaries, Mormon missionaries, come to try to help take care of this tree that fell on our property. We don't have a lot right now to give out. We've had a lot of medical stuff going on this year, but we have chickens. So we gave them a few dozen eggs.
Yeah.
I mean, like, just anything to say, you know, to know that they're being thought of, that you're there with them in spirit, you know, just something to help, you know, anything.
Just to be kind.
Just kindness, exactly. And we need more of that in the world, is just kindness. But thank y'all for listening to this little spiel. I hope it wasn't, you know, too depressing for y'all.
Yeah.
And thank you, Producer Mike, for sharing what you've seen out there.
Yeah.
I know that was a pretty sad day when you came home and were
It was rough, yeah.
That was unrecognizable places you've been going to your entire life and don't even hardly know where you are because the landmarks are gone. But again, thank y'all, and I hope y'all enjoy the rest of the show.
Now back to our regular programming.
So if y'all can help, y'all please click on these links that I'm going to include in the show notes. We'll just all try to do what we can. Thanks, everybody. And now on with the show. Well, it is September, and that means spooky season is right around the corner. Producer Mike and I will be headed to Halloween Horror Nights next week. I cannot wait. We skipped last year, but after we saw all what the houses and stuff were going to be, this year we bit the bullet and we're like, you know what? We deserve this trip. After the year we have had, we deserve it. And it's only one night, so you know, we're going to make the best of it and going to have a blast. And I keep watching the weather and it looks like, fingers crossed, y'all, it may not rain that night, and that will be the best if it does not rain, because the last time we went, we were drenched the entire time we were in the parks. I will be sure to share with y'all what our favorite houses were and pictures on our social media when we get back and before the next episode comes out. So now let's dig up some history making news. Y'all, I struggled with this week as I'm writing this, which was, I started writing this a couple weeks ago, but y'all don't tell anybody. It was the 538th anniversary of the Battle of Bosworth Field in Leicestershire, England. On August 22nd, 1485, the last of the Yorks were defeated, ending the Plantagenet line. They were conquered by the army of Henry Tudor, future King Henry VII. Richard III was captured and killed during the battle. There were so many rumors as to what happened to the body of the fallen king, many of which were made up probably about 100 years after his death by none other than William Shakespeare. In September 2012, the truth was finally found with the discovery of Richard's remains. He had originally been buried in Greyfriars Priory, but the church was lost after the Reformation. Hundreds of years pass, and the property is developed. After much research by the Ricardian Society, they narrowed down the possible site of the last York king's final resting place. They garnered funding from several backers under the guise of excavating the old priory. And y'all, sure enough, the king was there. under a parking space that just so happened to be marked with an R. Well, and yesterday was the 123rd anniversary of the Great Storm of 1900. Y'all scroll back in your podcast apps to episode number 22 for what happened on the night of September 8th, 1900 on Galveston Island. It will leave little wonder as to why the whole island has the possibility of being haunted. Welcome to episode 71, The Ghosts of 1900. And y'all, I have been back and forth over today's episode. Focus on one location or cover multiple? But y'all know I love threes. So I've chosen three locations of note, and shall we say, with some pretty good ghost stories and haunting history attached to them. So first, we're going to head down to 1402 Broadway and the Bishop's Palace, also known as the Gresham Castle. It was built for the Gresham family, who came to Galveston in 1866 after the Civil War. Ground was broken in 1886 and the family of 11 moved in. In 1892, Walter, the patriarch of the family, was a former state legislator, then a one-term U.S. congressman. An attorney by trade, he was also a founder of the Gulf, Santa Fe, and Colorado Railroads. He was known as a railway magnate. In 1868, he opened a law office on Galveston Island, married his wife Josephine, and soon after was elected as Galveston County Attorney. He would become the highest paid lawyer of his time in the whole state of Texas. As I mentioned before, the castle was commissioned in 1886. The family moved in 1892, and a grand reception was held. The lady of the house was a lover of grand parties, and she herself an artist. She filled the castle with murals that she hand-painted, and so much greenery, the guests felt like they were in a botanical garden. She was known to throw lavish parties that would last until the next day. She would have pillows laid on the stairs and scattered other places so that the guests could nap if they needed to, before carrying on refreshed and ready for another round of merrymaking. Now that you know a little bit about the original owners, let's talk about the building itself and the role it played in saving an incredible number of lives during the Great Storm. Construction began in 1888, taking 6 years to complete. It was designed by famous architect, Irish-born Nicholas Clayton. The castle, as the Greshams called it, came with a price tag of $250,000, which would be a little over $6 million today. And y'all, with the current housing market, that sounds like a steal, especially when it was within sight of the beach. And I really wonder what it would actually sell for today. This place is amazing. Just wait until you see the pictures of it. Anyway, back to the castle's construction. And I'm not using palace yet, because at this time, it was still just called the castle. The home was built completely from granite and sandstone. The facade is that of a grand Gothic castle, complete with a turret and animal carvings on the different moldings. Three stories sit on top of an above-ground basement level. The basement being where the kitchens were located, as well as the servants' quarters. The upper three levels were all very formal, and that was the family space up there. That September 9, 1900, the Greshams opened their doors to around 600 refugees from the Great Storm. All lives within were saved. The family continued to house and help their neighbors while the recovery began. The cleanup took a couple of years. And in that time, the entire island was raised over a dozen feet by reinforced steel, sand, and crushed granite and concrete. In 1920, Walter Gresham went to Washington to try to garner more economic help to complete the seawall construction that continues to save the island from future disasters. Walter passed away suddenly while helping his home. He was 79, so maybe it wasn't all that sudden. His body was returned home by train, and he was laid to rest in the Lakeview Cemetery. But apparently, it wasn't just Walter's body that returned to Galveston, but his spirit as well. And where should we go next? Maybe somewhere on the Strand, the Hutchings Seely Building. It was also designed by famed architect Nicholas Clayton in 1895. What was to be a bank and a dry goods wholesale warehouse was constructed out of pink and gray granite along with red Texas sandstone. I really need to see these places in person. Galveston is definitely on my list of southern cities to visit. The building was originally two or three separate buildings that after their makeover were made to look like one grand building. And she's home to several spirits that are thought to be lingering after the storm. Everything from whisperings, the mutterings of scared people huddled together on the third floor, hoping to survive. A little boy in disheveled clothes is sometimes a mischief maker, leaving behind handprints on jewelry cases and glass doors after closing time. In one story, a necklace on display went missing right at closing. The staff searched and searched, but with no luck. But upon opening the next morning, it was found sitting right on top of its case, like it had always been there. At other times, he can be heard playing, but when someone goes to investigate, there's no one to be seen. He's also known to leave a mess behind. In one shop, he scattered a stack of local magazines during the night for the staff to come in and to find the next morning. On the second floor, there are sounds of heavy footsteps, of doors rattling, almost like the upper floor is coming apart. Maybe leftover energy from that awful night? Our last specter in the Hutchings Seely Building is that of a young woman who has been named Sarah, her real name lost to time, but the memory of her heroism lives on. It's said that the spirit of the young woman in a white gown, probably a nightgown, because of what time of night that the storm struck, is spotted on the stairs. She's normally rushing towards the upper floors. While she took shelter there, she balanced on a window ledge and pulled both survivors and the dead who came floating by the third story window. They lined the storeroom floor with those still alive and with those who had succumbed. They were placed on the far side of the room. Sarah stayed even after the storm, caring for the victims until she herself was taken by one of the epidemics that rolled through the once grand port city after the hurricane. And apparently, she's still there trying to help the victims who are all long gone. Okay, and here's our last one. And this may be one of the most famous hauntings because of its location. The Seawall Walmart. And y'all heard that right. Galveston is home to a haunted Walmart. The living people in Walmart are scary enough, but this one has ghost kids. And maybe a lot of them, because this Walmart was built on the site of the St. Mary's Orphanage. The orphanage was founded in 1867 in response to the many yellow fever epidemics to hit the island. The sisters moved the children to their permanent location in 1874 in the tall dunes and seagrass right on the beach. By 1900, when tragedy struck, the orphanage was home to 90 kids and 10 nuns. All but three little boys perished. One nun was still found clinging tightly to the two smallest children. Her name was Sister Catherine. She and her fellow sisters and all of the children were all buried on the beach where they were found. And now a Walmart stands where those lost sisters and children once took refuge. Witnesses say that the children are rarely ever seen, but are most definitely heard. The sounds of balls bouncing, children laughing, motion-activated toys going off on empty aisles. And they say after Hurricane Ike, Walmart allowed FEMA workers into the partially destroyed store for supplies. While in there, several people heard the laughter of children, also wheezing and hacking coughs. Fearing that children had gotten into the store, they searched it from top to bottom and found no one. Another story comes from a Walmart employee who worked overnight. They said that after 1 a.m. is when the activity really starts to amp up. This is also the time that the storm was at its worst. Is this a coincidence, or are the children trying to overcome the fear that they had on that most awful night? Side notes. I have two or three for this go around. First, the castle. Looking at old photos of the castle after the great storm, y'all, those people would have had to have been excavated out of there. The debris was piled as high as the third floor. This one-time family home is now listed in the top most important buildings in the U.S. I believe that was the top 100 buildings in the U.S. And lastly, do y'all think that there is something to this stone tape theory? Two out of the three locations were built from granite and sandstone, and both have hauntings that have been witnessed by multiple people. Then we have the Seawall Walmart, with its disembodied voices and cries. The nuns chose this location for their children's home because of the Gulf breezes, hoping that the winds would keep the disease-spreading mosquitoes away. Instead, they, 87 kids, and their refuge by the sea were all destroyed. Now for our oldest house or building by state, brought to us by the Discoverer blog. And where are we now? Y'all, we've hit the ends. We're in New Jersey. The oldest building can be found in Gibbstown. It is a wooden structure built from white oak. The old place is privately owned and can be visited by appointment only. And then we have New Mexico, the land of enchantment. I think that's right. And this one is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Located in Taos Pueblo, these adobe structures were built more than 1,000 years ago by Native Americans using adobe bricks. And yeah, y'all, this episode's been a little bit different, but I really felt like producer Mike and I needed to get the word out about how badly many residents in North Florida have been affected by Idalia. Help is here while the news is here, but then it's forgotten. And y'all, these folks with trees through their houses, they haven't forgotten. And we're trying to help the rest of us to not forget that there's people still out there struggling in this. We're going to post, like I said before, post some links to some local charities. And if you can, you know, click on them and see what you can do. Even if it's sending a pack of diapers to a family or to a church or something that could go to somebody. So if you can help, please do. Because y'all, hurricane season doesn't end until November. Y'all be sure to follow us on social media, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. I always post pictures to go along with every episode. If you really liked what you heard, check out our Patreon. You get 3 extra episodes a month over there. 1 being a full episode and 2 being producer Mike and I doing a recap of whatever the story was for that week on the regular feed. If you want to get in contact, you can email the show at laurathesouth@gmail.com. And with that, we'll talk to y'all later on the next episode of Laura of the South. Bye, y'all.